Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Chris Clemens. He is the Senior Associate Dean for Natural Sciences and Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he's also interested in a new development, which was new to me, and I'm surprised that I wasn't in on this, but there is a new Institute for Convergent Science at Carolina. And Chris, I got really excited about it when you talked to a downtown group very recently. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you. The Institute for Convergent Science is an institute in formation. So we're still learning how to do this thing called convergent science. And let me give you a short definition of that, as short as I can manage here. You understand that science is divided into disciplines because we have departments around these disciplines. So we think about the biology department, the physics department, which is the one I'm in, and it has astronomy too. So there are two things there at least. But that's one way to think about science. When science gets very well developed and complex, of course, you need these specialists and you need to train people in their specializations. But there's a different way to think about what we're doing, and it is a question-driven way. Start with a question, a tough research question, like how do you make something that treats Alzheimer's, maybe a brain implant that can deliver drugs directly into the brain? You're going to need more than just experts on neurosciences who understand the disease. You're going to need a polymer scientist who can make something that could live in the brain. You're going to need a pharmacologist who knows how to do maybe the drug delivery portion of that. And so we've been trying to arrange our thinking around the series of interesting questions. And, you know, one of the first questions is, how do you pick those? So once you think in that way, you realize that you're not going to answer those questions in one discipline. So the second thing about convergent science, and this is where the name comes from, you want to converge the right experts from across the disciplines and work on the question in a focused way with some objective that may be pure science but may also be a real thing, a product, a solution, something that goes out and makes a difference in the world. And the Institute for Convergent Science is our idea for a way to both build a space and a program that speeds up that effort, that makes it easier to cross the barriers that live between these disciplines and helps bring the scientists together and focus their attention on the final outcome, which we hope serves not just, our intellectual curiosity, but fulfills the mandate of the people of the state. When they fund a university, they expect us to come up with solutions for some of the world's problems. So this is the idea. It's we're learning how to do it.
You know, In the past, we've looked at our institutions of higher education, particularly at the undergraduate level, but also in the graduate level as well, to provide the fundamental background in particular areas, and to develop expertise in those areas. The idea that we're in the new problem-solving business has over time developed, and universities have accepted responsibility for addressing important current problems. But fundamentally, we train the people to do that, but we train them in their specialties of their science. And how do you break us out of that way of thinking?
Well, I don't think you should break entirely out. So I'm from the College of Arts and Sciences, and this is where the Institute for Convergent Science will live. It is, of course, going to be a much bigger effort, touching all of the schools, touching all of the infrastructure for innovation. People may not understand that at the University of North Carolina, we have a vice chancellor for economic development, innovation, and a whole apparatus, Innovate Carolina, to help take our scientific discoveries and make them into companies or other solutions, new drugs in some cases. This is a different view of the university than from 200 years ago or more when we started. It's a responsibility, really, I think, that the universities in general have taken on. If you're a large research university receiving money from the taxpayers, of course you fulfill your mandate to train students. But you have an additional mandate here in the modern world, which is to be innovators and to figure out how to bring these basic research ideas into economic development opportunities. We want our students to participate in that. So you can imagine doing that in companies where there are R&D labs. You can imagine doing that in an isolated way. I think the beauty of the College of Arts and Sciences approach to convergent science is we're going to be doing this not just in front of, but with the cooperation and participation of our undergraduate and graduate students, who will not only be learning their disciplines, they'll be learning to think across those into other disciplines, and they'll be learning that process whereby you take your invention and you make it into a product, a company, or something that serves society beyond the walls of the university.
Well, you all are already involved in this. Some of this is happening
on
our campus.
That's
and
right.
Can you, what are some of the either successful or the instructive failures of this kind of operation that have inspired you and given you confidence that we can invest a lot of resources in making this a big priority?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to think about that. I can answer that as sort of institutional efforts to streamline our ability to do innovation or to help scientists understand how to, when they've invented something, how to make that into a product. And then there are the individual companies that have succeeded. So from the College of Arts and Sciences, there have been a number of companies that have spun out with various solutions. Probably the most famous is Carbon, which was founded by a faculty member, Jody Simone, and others. That company is having big success in what's called additive manufacturing. We think about machining. You take a part, you build it by taking away part of the material, either with a cutting or some other device. What he's learning to do is to build up, fabricate by adding to, and this allows them to make much more complex.
We think 3D printer when you
3D printer. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You can make much more complex parts that do different things. So you have to rethink your whole design effort. And so he's sort of at the forefront of that in his company, Carbon. We have another company started by Mark Shanefish that's using nitric oxide as an antibiotic and developing molecules that deliver that for things like acne treatment and hopefully to cure some infectious diseases. So we already have these existing successes. The question is, how do we make that more routine? How do we first identify the problems that are interesting? How do we convene the team of scientists who are the appropriate people to solve the problem? And then how do we teach them in collaboration with all of the efforts at the university to help form companies? And this includes people who are worrying about licensing and people who are worrying about how do you get a space to start the company when you don't have any money? How do you go raise that money? So we have all that apparatus. How do we shorten the cycle? How do we encourage that and promote it in ways that make us not just good at this but great at this so that people look at North Carolina and say, not only is that a place where I want to send my child to get a great undergraduate education, I want to send them there because they know how to be innovators and entrepreneurs in the global marketplace and to join the global workforce with all those skills.
Well, you've asked a lot of questions, and you're developing the answers to some of them. What are some of the answers that are coming along about how you do this?
Right. I was in a meeting today. One of our partnerships in the college is with the Vice Chancellor for Research's office, and he started an effort to create creativity hubs. This is a very convergent exercise. Try to get together in a hub people who know how to work on a problem. One of the first awards has been given to a group led by Theo Dingemans. He's a member of our faculty in the college. He's a polymer scientist, among other things. He's trying to create a membrane that will essentially allow you to take salt out of seawater. Now, these membranes exist already, but they're fairly low-technology devices. He's trying to take something new, which is little platelets of something called graphene oxide. It's made of essentially carbon, to embed those in a polymer in the correct way, to make a membrane that's really highly selective but allows the water to go through in a very quick way, so much more permeable. The problem is you spend a lot of energy taking salt out of seawater. This would lower the energy requirements by a lot. So he's working on this product. And what I found interesting about the convergent part of this in his case, at the meeting today, he brought in the team of mathematical modelers. And the point he wanted to make was, if he just makes something and then tests it and it doesn't work and he has to make a different thing, it's a very complicated space he's working in. He may have to make a million different samples. This is how Thomas Edison used to work. He would set up a lab and they would just go at it making millions of copies of things that are slightly different and asking which one of these works in a battery. Well, we have numerical modeling tools today that will allow Theo and his team, which includes Greg Forrest, Orlando Cornell, and folks from other places than the College of Arts and Sciences, like the School of Public Health, he will be able to run computer models of the first sample and ask, how do we match its properties in the computer, and how would we tune those properties differently to make it work better? And so instead of making millions of generations of something to get it right, it'll take it down to two or three generations because you're using the computer model along with measurements of the device to shorten the loop, if you like, to make it much quicker convergence on what it is you wanted, which is a product that lets the water through and stops the salt.
Is there something that you all have done to facilitate your principal investigator reaching out more broadly than he might outside of his or her department? Did this new convergence effort make that possible, or was this just a happenstance that the person who's working on this polymer filter, I guess, is what you'd call it, that he just knows some people in campus and brought them in, or how?
No, this was a concerted effort, not in my office, but in the vice chancellor for research office, to ask people to come together around five or six key areas and bring interdisciplinary proposals that address specific problems using teams of people drawn from across the university. So the proposals were put in last year. There were 50 or so proposals. And then we went through a process to identify which ones of these look like they're close to being doable, which ones could, for the amount of money we have, which is not huge, but it's a substantial amount, who could get to a solution in a short amount of time. But what we're talking about in the Institute for Convergent Science is putting even more structure around this program. So this program indeed gives money to the investigator. It incentivizes them to build their team. In the room today, we had people from technology development and people from our innovation sphere who are working on patents because that's part of the process. But we don't have somebody looking way downstream and saying, let's think about the impact of this. If it's going to be used for water, that's for human consumption, what are the regulatory questions that we need to think about right up front? Because he may have a choice of chemicals that he puts into this membrane. And in the middle of the meeting, these questions were asked, and we had an expert there from the University of Texas who said, well, you're going to need NSF, National Sanitation Foundation, to actually test and approve anything that makes water for human consumption. And the question was, why don't we think about that now? So you don't get to the end of a process and find out that you made a choice somewhere along the way that fails the standards you're going to need in the end. This is not something a basic scientist working on polymers for membranes might think of. But by getting this structure and starting to develop programs in the Institute, we will start to be able to clear the hurdles out of the way early in the process, so we don't go through a process that makes something that's extremely useful but can't be put into service for its intended purpose.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Chris Clemens. He's telling us about a relatively new venture on our campus at Carolina called Convergent Science. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Chris Clemens. He is professor of physics and astronomy, and he's also the associate dean for natural sciences and is deeply involved in a new effort on campus around what is called convergent science. Chris, before we took a break, you were explaining to me an example of a new research effort and potential product that's underway now and would be illustrative of the kinds of things that you'd like to have going. I call it a product, and it's not a product yet. It's a research project now, but I'm envisioning a product that would, without a great deal of energy, would turn seawater into drinking water.
Right.
And I hadn't thought of some of the problems you all are thinking about. Even though the product's not even developed yet, you're thinking about some of the problems that might be associated if you should, say, hit a home run with developing.
That's right. I think so. So part of what we want to implement in our Institute for Convergent Science is a framework for innovation that speeds it up, This is not cheap to do. Basic research is expensive. And then product development is expensive. A lot of that expense is just time. You need people's time. And then if you get downstream and find out you made a mistake in step one by not considering the regulations or the laws or the patents or other protections you need, you can slow it down by hitting a hurdle that you can't go over quickly. So the idea of an innovation framework that lives in convergent science is to think about the impact you want on the first day and to build the team, fleshing it out beyond the basic scientists with folks who think about all the hurdles that might get in the way. So if there's a regulatory hurdle, you think about it on day one, and you do all of your work to avoid hitting that hurdle. This is going to be a much faster way to do innovation. Mm-hmm. But we're building that framework now, and we're testing that framework now.
The other part of it is that once you've got the research project has been successful and you have something that could be turned into a product, and the one that you've put in front of us is a product that would filter out salt out of salt water. And that would be, we can imagine, that's a billion-dollar product, isn't it?
Well, it depends on how much better it is. There are things that do that today, right? And if it's twice as good and it displaces that whole market, it would be a very big product, and that would be the hope. But I'm more excited than that about this particular thing because it's not, as you said, it's not yet a product. It's a basic science effort or science project, if you like. It is also what I think of as a platform technology. And so in our innovation framework, we want to develop seriously a few platforms for technology. And what I mean by that is this fellow Theo Dingemans and his team have a methodology for making membranes that could do many different things. One of them is to take salt out of seawater. Another one might be to mine metals out of seawater. So if you could make a membrane that was selective for certain metals, and I'm thinking maybe now rare earth elements that are expensive to mine from the earth and rare, as they're called, if you could take those out of seawater economically,
There's a lot in seawater other than just salt.
There are a lot more metals dissolved in the ocean than there are mineable from the earth. So you have a potentially much larger supply there, but of course it's very dilute. And you're not going to boil the water to take it out because the energy required to get even a small amount is crazy. But if you had a selective membrane that you could just pump seawater through and put it back in the sea, but you're taking out one or two key things, now you're mining from the ocean. The same technology. In batteries, there are membranes that need to be selectively permeable. So Theo is working with a team at Virginia Tech on battery technology. So he's developed a generalized methodology for making selective membranes that we would hope would not result in one solution, but many, many different solutions. And so if you have an innovation framework you've built correctly, those solutions get out to the market quicker. And the ones that don't work disappear quickly. You don't try to push them along. So if in the middle of the research you find out, you know, it turns out to be really hard to get this salt out, but I could take uranium out really quickly, then you pivot, right? You don't insist to solve the problem you started with if nature is showing you a way to solve an easier problem.
So it reminds me that most of of product development research, as you pointed out with Edison, most of it's failures. You just have to hit a home run once out of every.
That's right. That's right.
So that and you hear in some commercial labs that when there's a failure, the guy in charge says, "Well, that's great. Let's celebrate our failures because failures are the stepping stones to success." And does this convergent science take that into account, or do you have to point towards developing a successful product out of all research?
Well, I think that's part of the innovation framework. That's very different. If you're a basic scientist, you go to the National Science Foundation. They give you money. Normally, they give you a 3-year chunk all at once. What they ask for in the end is that you publish some results. So you have to do that if you're going to get more money. But let's suppose the experiment or the question you're asking, the answer turns out to be no. Well, everybody's perfectly happy. You publish the result, and other people now don't have to bother with that line of research. So you've done everybody a service, and your product is a paper. Well, what if you knew in the first 6 months it wasn't going to work? They don't take the money back. They don't monitor you at that level. Now, most people will use it productively to do something else. In the innovation framework and the Convergent Science Institute, we want to make projects that I've titled Nimble Projects. And so it suggests that we need to be nimble on our feet, but it also stands for new invention, make it big or leave early. We're not going to dump a lot of money on somebody who has something in an early stage and then watch it fail quickly and leave the money there or give them space that they inhabit at the expense of someone else. We're going to say, look, that was great. You got a certain way down the road, and then you learn what you had proposed is not going to work out, not in the way that you thought. Maybe you can see a way there, but it's going to be too expensive, so it's not a market solution. Well, go back to your lab. Think some more. Let's take the funding that we had for the second step and let's start something new. And let's do this. Let's churn this much more quickly so that we test the ideas and reject. Most of them will be bad ideas. Let's reject them quickly so we don't spend time and effort on something that's not a solution. And let's take the ones that work through more quickly. So that is very well built into this system. And that's a different model. So nobody, even in the innovation work going on at Carolina, has tried this approach that's a much more hands-on, milestone-based approach where funding can be retracted or only given out piecemeal in order to hit the appropriate milestones. That's that guided approach where you have a team of innovation experts alongside the scientists helping them. That's part of the novel thing we want to do in this innovation framework.
You mentioned a couple of stars like Joe DeSimone who've hit home runs with this type of approach. My image of the typical scientist who's doing research is that researcher is focused on his or her love of projects and is not necessarily thinking of it in any sort of product development or even from an entrepreneurial standpoint. If I'm right about that or partially right about that, how do you either deal with that fact or how do you stimulate smart people who are basically research-minded to break out of that mold?
That's a great question. I think I want to start by saying we ask a lot of our science faculty. Well, we ask a lot of all our faculty. The science faculty are the ones I know most. The people of North Carolina should feel very good about the value they get from our faculty. They come, of course, with basic research interests in their research areas or even applied research interests. They come, we hope, to the College of Arts and Sciences with a passion for teaching. So all of our faculty spend at least half their time teaching undergraduates or graduate students. And if you have a third passion for innovating and making companies, you can almost see that as one passion too many. I've got to get my grants and do my research. I've got to train these students. And now I'm thinking about how I make a product and take it to market. And one of the problems with that in the traditional model without our new innovation framework is the minute you have an invention, there's a lot of encouragement to patent it and start a company. Well, what happens to your students who worked on it with you? If you own part of a company, the students can't go work in the company and be your PhD student or your advisee.
Sorry to interrupt this, but in an ordinary research project, if there is such a thing as an ordinary research project, but in my idea of the usual research project on a university campus is that it works great because the faculty member inspires identifies students who can appropriately take a part in this scientific research, and it works. It works great, at least for those who are inspired to work on that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated, and it goes both ways. In a way, the grad students and at Carolina, certainly the undergraduates, because we involve a large fraction, maybe 80% of our science undergraduates are involved in laboratory research. It's an interaction. I have my own research grants, I have ideas. I throw the ideas out into my research group, and they don't come back looking like they did when I threw them out. We have conversations in which the students have the ideas and inspire me to pursue something. And you won't be faculty at Carolina if you don't love that part. But if someone, let's suppose I have in the past invented something I want to commercialize, my students have to make a choice. I can't supervise them for grades and have them work in a company that I may own some ownership in. That's a conflict of interest. So part of our innovation framework is to say, let's don't move it to the company. Let's do the product development in the Institute for Convergent Science where the students can participate in every step. Now you don't have to separate your passion for teaching those students, you actually expand it. Because I think now I'm not training my student just to do basic science and come up with research papers to publish on that. I'm training my student to take their basic research and translate it into a company, and they're going to participate in every step of developing that technology.
These are undergraduate students as well as
they are undergraduate,
mostly graduate students.
I wouldn't characterize it as mostly grad students. People think of grad students as the ones who dedicate themselves more fully to research, but we have a lot more by number undergraduate students. And because we have so many of them participating in research, I feel that the undergraduates are a key part of this. Yeah. We have innovators who are 19 years old, who want not only to be in that research lab learning about ways to discover drugs using RNA screening techniques, they want to take these RNA screening techniques into a product. They want to see that as a drug that cures disease. They want to be a part of that whole piece.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Dr. Chris Clemens. We're talking about a new institute on the campus, the Institute for Convergent Science. He's explaining it and getting me excited about it, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Chris Clemens. He's a professor of physics and astronomy, and I'd love for you to come back someday and let's talk about the stars.
I'd be happy to.
And how to measure them.
We might need more than 45 minutes.
Yeah, and what we can learn by new ways of looking at those stars. But we're talking today about your primary interest, which is this new Institute for Convergent Science. And we're talking about how it works, but you've got big plans for making it work more efficiently and better.
That's right. We want to be a world leader in innovation and entrepreneurship. I haven't talked about it, but we have an entrepreneurship minor and a program in the college that trains entrepreneurs. A lot of that is around the business aspects, the financial aspects. Of course, you also need a product. And so what we're talking about here is how you take basic science research and translate it into solutions, new drugs, new ways to filter water that we were talking about, new batteries, new ways to solve energy problems.
Chris, excuse me, but I mean, as you're talking, you know, when I'm growing up again, I'm thinking of the Bell Labs and the Edison
yep.
Labs. I'm thinking of, and then the drug industry's great scientific research. I'm thinking that's where that's where we, America, has been strong in terms of being a great researcher. Are you suggesting that we got to do it a different way now?
Well, I think that model has shifted all by itself. So we're not at the front end of that. We just want to be best at it. But a lot of companies have lowered their R&D budget. Basic research is less and less a part of corporate America's world. Of course, it still is a big part of it. And the universities have stepped into that using funding from the state and federal government. A lot of the innovation that leads to products happens in the universities. Almost all of the major companies that you see today in some way have technologies that developed in a university laboratory. So we have to be the skunk works, if you like, the Bell Labs. And the question is, as academics, we don't want to overthink it, but can we put some structure and discipline and a framework on the innovation that makes us better at it? Can we think about and analyze how innovation itself works and build an institute that makes us so good at that we become the leader in the world? We're studying what other people do. We've really looked at this model at the Wyss Institute that Harvard has set up. And we know what the pieces look like. You want to have scientists who have these platform technologies we were talking about, technologies that don't solve one problem but solve a succession of problems. And then you want each of those solutions to have a streamlined pathway into real-world applications. So if you want to take salt out of seawater, you want to have that on the market quickly. You want it to be cheaper than anybody's solution, and you want to be able to scale it so that you can build it in large volume at a small cost. So those are not traditionally academic problems, and that's why we have to build a framework that looks at all of that and brings in the experts. So really this institute, and it's in its early days, we're putting together the funding. We're going to pilot some of the programs, and we've already started some of that. But we're learning. We don't claim to know it all. I don't know how to do this. I mean, there's not one person who does. So it's really about partnerships. We want to partner with Commerce Department, with all of our innovation experts at Innovate Carolina, with the Vice Chancellor for Research, of course, with the med school. We want to work closely with the other schools. So there are many, many pieces on campus that we want to draw together and work together on this new innovation framework that we will implement, hopefully, to the benefit of everyone.
You know, I'm going to take a break because you told me that you have a new building in mind.
That's right.
And I want to start with that after we take this short break.
Be happy to.
I'm visiting with Dr. Chris Clemons, a professor of astronomy, and he's also the Senior Associate Dean for Natural Sciences and a leader in the new effort at Carolina in its new Institute for Convergent Science. And he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Professor Chris Clemons and I have been talking about science, and we're talking about innovation, and we've been talking about product development within the university framework and a lot of new stuff. And we're also talking about money.
That's right. I think, of course, we are grateful for the great support from the legislature and the people of North Carolina who pay the bills so we can educate students and engage in these fun innovations. We feel like we're paying it back if we develop companies that contribute jobs to the economy and products. But we're not going to do that in the traditional model. So what we were talking about was convergent science, where you ask a question that you think is ripe to be solved. You think you have the talent to solve it, but it is critical that you get the talent. So recently we started a new department, the Applied Physical Sciences, and we're hiring in talent, especially around this convergent science. So the fellow I was talking about, Theo Dingemans, Dr. Theo Dingemans.
Is he new?
He has been hired into this new department. But what we're learning is the spaces that we allocate. Back to this traditional model where you have a biology department, a physics department, you put the researchers in these departments and they each have a lab. They operate in that lab. They get federal money perhaps to run their research programs. But when you start one of these new projects that crosses disciplines, where are they going to pursue this? We think we need a convergent space. We need a space and a building that has a large area that's a research commons that brings together undergrads, professors in a way that's not assigned. It's checked out like library books. You have a meeting room. You want to put together a proposal for one of these creativity hubs that the vice chancellor is trying to promote convergent research around. You need a meeting space. You know, the department meeting spaces are not on someone's home turf. So you go to neutral turf and get together. And you find out in that building there's a makerspace. We have this new network called BEAM where students can go learn how to use plastic printers, laser cutters to build prototypes of their own inventions or things for class. And so while you're meeting, you step over and realize, why don't we just cook up a part? We've got a drawing of the piece I was trying to tell you about. I'm gonna make a mechanical model of it in software, and then we're going to cut it out, and we're going to fit it together. So we're not only thinking about a space that has the ability to draw people together and participate in the programming. It has very open, visible areas where people are building things. And then maybe one floor up, you imagine a set of labs that are not assigned to a particular discipline. They're assigned to these nimble projects where people go in, do their development, and either fail and get out quickly or succeed and take a little longer to bring the product all the way to market. This is a new way of thinking about space and the way we use it. And I think many universities have started to build this kind of space. So we're talking about a convergent sciences building. It would have our new department in it, but it would have a lot of space reserved just for these kinds of fertile interactions between scientists and space for temporary projects with no owner. So the space doesn't become anybody's kingdom.
I'm trying to visualize this in terms of something that I'm familiar with. I mean, it's like a market, open market, like the Carborough food market. It changes. People come, they do their stuff, but I don't see. I'm trying to visualize this with the senior chemistry professor coming over to the commons, and how does he or she fit in to that exciting?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, first of all, the first person who goes over is probably the students of the senior chemistry professor, because the students realize they're trying to do something in a lab, let's say, and if they just had a little a widget or a jig of some kind, they could do this experiment a lot more quickly. And in the old days, you would make up some drawings, take it to a machinist, and after some amount of time, you might have a part. They just run down and print the plastic part. This is how our kids are today. You know, if they need an app on their iPhone, they code up something, and we're going to have an app lab on campus teaching kids how to do this better. So they make the electronics, they make the app, they make the parts to do the experiment. So the students find it first. They're the leaders because the—
So the physics and chemistry and biology student or whoever's coming from the College of Arts and Sciences, science labs and classrooms, they're not going to be as individual, or they're not going to be so wedded to
their— They're not as specialized.
Yeah.
They will still get their specialized training, but they will have opportunities that we didn't have because they have technologies that we didn't have. You know, rapid prototyping is here, and the students are learning how to do it in makerspaces we already have on campus. But what will happen then is the professor will start to be interested in where this student is going and coming back with this neat stuff, and then they'll hear there's a program. We're put together a funding opportunity for anyone who thinks they can solve a set of key problems that we've developed in partnership with industry.
Go find your partner. Go find your partner.
We have a great relationship with someone like Eastman Chemical. They come to us and say, we have this problem. Our R&D scientists can't work on it. Can you work on it? We bring the problem. We bring the people there. The professor comes in and he says, we got a team. I think I know a few people around campus, maybe someone at NC State or Duke, maybe someone outside of the state. We know how to think about this. I can't interrupt the experiment going on in my lab, though, and so I think we'll do it after I finish the three-year grant that I'm on right now. Well, we say, no, look what we've got here. We've got a limited number of these spaces that are meant for this. We will assign you one. You write us a proposal, but put the milestones in. In 6 months, you need to have the first working prototype of whatever it is you're making. We'll give you the money. We'll help you with your team. We won't interfere with your space. Your students will have a field day in here. It is a Skunk Works. It's a very dynamic space as we envision it. They get to that first milestone and they say, you know what? We've got something here. So let's continue. Let's use this space out until we have something that we know works. Now let's talk about the commercialization. The students have done the fun part. The faculty have done the fun part. They've done it together in a team, and they've learned things about innovation. Now let's go and let's—
So maybe other people, bring other people who are—
Let's let our folks at Innovate Carolina, who know how to incorporate in Delaware, who know how to protect the intellectual property. That's not something many of our students will be interested in. Of course, if they are, they can do that too in our entrepreneurship program.
Well, this has been a wonderful time with you. And I have to ask one more question.
Sure.
Since we're in Chapel Hill, and the people who've been listening to us are thinking, well, all that's well and good for the campus and— But what's in it for me as a resident of Chapel Hill? Is this going to change my life at all?
Well, it will change your life. If we do it right, it'll change everybody's life, because what will happen is these companies like Carbon and the other companies that have come out of UNC will multiply in number. Some of them will locate in North Carolina. They'll make jobs for our residents, jobs for our children, jobs for the next generation. And if they're making nitric oxide antibiotics that treat antibiotic-resistant bacteria, they may save your life. And so I feel like it's touching every part of our life if we do it right. And if we get really, really good at this, that investment that the people make in the university is returning educated citizenry, and almost as a byproduct, building the companies and the technologies that are going to make everybody's life better in the future. So I think, you know, that's the broad vision of a modern university, and I think we already do it well at Carolina. This institute is to make us best in class.
Great. Well, on the parallel question is, are there things that people in Chapel Hill can do for and with you and your colleagues?
Well, I think I haven't said it yet, but I'm envisioning this building also as an arts and humanities space. We would like to have a green there. This building is going to be built as part of the current science complex. And we want it to be a community space as well. So my vision is the perfect day. On the perfect day, we will have a large convening space in this building, and we will pipe in one of our companies being listed on the NASDAQ exchange in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see our faculty member and his team ringing the bell or on the screen. And then maybe in the evening, we'll have the summer jazz concert out on the green, or maybe a Shakespearean play that we can watch as a community. So I think the more we have participation from the community and buy-in here, the happier we'll all be.
Well, Chris Clemons, thank you very much. Thanks for being our visitor, and thanks for what you're doing in terms of moving us forward into the new world that awaits us, we hope, like a dreamland.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.